I'm a bit surprised that the oil market are happy to trade at fairly low volatility when the underlying markets are quite challenged and can be challenged. But that's just the situation. And we have not been trading this market with all this noise, and still we are trading with low volatility, which we again also seen in the equity market and on index level, and also in the FX market. So let's see going forward that we are so confident that nothing can happen. But that's the situation right now.
Imagine spending an hour with the world's greatest traders. Imagine learning from their experiences, their successes, and their failures. Imagine no more. Welcome to Top Traders Unplugged, the place where you can learn from the best hedge fund managers in the world so you can take your manager, due diligence, or investment career to the next level. Before we begin today's conversation, remember to keep two things in mind. All the discussion we'll have about investment performance is about the past, and past performance does not guarantee or even infer anything about future performance. Also understand that there's a significant risk of financial loss with all investment strategies, and you need to request and understand the specific risks from the investment manager about their product before you make investment decisions. Here's your host, veteran hedge fund manager, Niels Kastrup Larsen.
Welcome and welcome back to another conversation in our series of episodes that focuses on markets and investing from a global macro perspective. This is a series that I not only find incredibly interesting as well as intellectually challenging, but also very important given where we are in the global economy and the geopolitical cycle. We want to dig deep into the minds of some of the most prominent experts to help us better understand what this new global macro-driven world may look like. We want to explore their perspectives on a host of game-changing issues and hopefully dig out nuances in their work through meaningful conversations. Please enjoy today's episode, hosted by Alan Dunn.
Thanks for the introduction, Niels. Today I'm joined by Tore Svelland, who is the founder and CIO at Svelland Capital, which is a discretionary commodities trader. Tore has over 30 years' experience investing in commodities and commodity-related markets. He started his career working for shipping companies in Oslo and Athens, and over the course of his career has traded at major commodities and trading houses such as Trafigura, Goldman Sachs, Carnegie, and Pareto. Tore, good to see you today. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very excited about this.
Good stuff. Well, no, it's great to have somebody with your unique background and experience in commodity markets coming on. So looking forward to the conversation. So I did touch on how you started off in shipping markets, but as we always do on the show, if you wouldn't mind giving us a sense of your background, how you got involved in shipping and then transitioned into more general commodities trading.
Yeah. So I started in the business back in 1989. I started working for a smaller Norwegian ship owning company. Learned the nitty-gritty back then, literally being on board a vessel, going to the ports and really see how it all works. Then I decided to also learn the Greek way of the same business, so I moved to Athens in 92. Athens back then was a little bit behind the rest of Europe from a technical point of view, but I would say on the shipping side they were very advanced and very successful. And I was keen just to learn and see how it all works in Athens. I think that, you know, both the Norwegians and the Greeks has been very successful in the shipping business, but they have always had a different approach to how they trade this market. Then the intention was to stay longer, but Klaveness offered an appealing position back in Oslo. So I moved back, spent many years in Klaveness. I think fantastic family and the company they had back then. I would say that to give the opportunities in the 90s to travel extensively in the Middle East, all over Asia, Australia, and in particular India, and also via Brazil on a few trips. So just to have that ability to learn the commodity market across metals and oil and shipping, at that, that just gave me the the confidence in, and that this is an interesting business. Yeah, then I moved on to be more on the financial side. So I joined Carnegie. Carnegie was back then very similar to Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, just a more Scandi size. They were very much into the shipping and the commodity. So, you know, running internal book and also getting a lot of clients, trading then the long, short equity versus commodity futures, and also shipping companies versus freight futures was kind of the beginning of the fund that we run today. Then later on, Goldman, as you mentioned, you know, the oil desk there with all the talented traders, all close friends today, working in great companies. So I really appreciate those 4 years, and then moving to Geneva, working in Trafigura and see Trafigura from the inside. And after 2 years, it was the right timing to start the fund. So which, no, it took like a year to set it all up. It's been up and running now for almost 7 years, and so far good results.
Good stuff. Well, fascinating background. And I mean, I know from reading some of your, you know, newsletters, you often talk about some of the kind of the shifting market microstructure and you know, quant strategies and the growing influence of CGAs and in some markets. I mean, taking a high level, you've been involved in commodity markets, you know, over a number of decades. Would you say the nature of the markets, the participants, has dramatically changed over that time? And I suppose, you know, I read Javier Blas's and his colleagues' book about this, and you know, it, back in the 70s and 80s, it seemed to be anything went in commodities, and a lot of shady deal making, etc. Is it much different these days?
Yeah. So when you go back to the 90s, you know, meeting people, trying to put a commodity trade together, finding the ship and moving from A to B, it was very much people-to-people business, and the price setting was thereafter. In today's world, with, as you mentioned, the CTAs, the macro funds, the multi-platforms, the commodity funds, and then you have the trading houses, I will say, bigger than ever and more successful. The banks like Goldman, Morgan, JP Morgan is not that involved as they used to be. So I would say the structure of the market has changed quite a lot. And you know, the way the futures are trading, it can move on some news, headline news. But on the long term, I would say the fiscal market will always be right and always will be the final price setter. But before you get to the fiscal delivery, we will sometimes have moves that we didn't have in the past.
Okay. And is that, I mean, you know, people point in some markets to, you know, the fact that the banks have retreated, you know, post Dodd-Frank, et cetera, they don't warehouse risk, et cetera. So would you say that has been a significant shift in the commodity markets as well?
Yeah, I think the way the banks was involved back in, 2006, 7, 8, and into 11, 12, 13, I think they did a very important job. They were the market makers. They were always there to show liquidity. Introducing new players to the market. You know, it was more difficult for them to act in this market, and they departed a lot of people and leaving them for the trading houses. The fiscal trading houses have a different attitude how to look at the market. It's more about moving a cargo from A to B and actually do the transaction. And then on top, you have the freight component. So it works very differently. I think the banks should stay there. But they decided to reduce their exposure, and hopefully they will be back one day. I think will be good for the market.
Okay, and obviously, you know, we tend to associate commodity markets with at times very high volatility and greater opportunities. And you know, every so often you see some of the traders posting very strong returns. I mean, do you think in general there's more inefficiency, there's more opportunity for active management in commodity markets?
Yeah, I think as long as you can trade this market and accept it is high volatility, and your risk system allow that kind of trading, then I would say it's a lot of opportunities. Not just on the commodity futures and freight futures, I will also say that the way we trade this market and look at the equity market versus the freight market, and you know, predicting on the shipping stocks and then on the commodity equities, whether we talk about the Exxon or the Equinor, or we're talking about the metals, the big metals ones, the Rio Tinto, BHP, etc. We see very often that they're kind of disconnected. The price in the equity market can sometimes be overly bearish and overly optimistic. We have seen over the last, I would say, 18 months to 24 months that the equity market in some cases have been too optimistic. And that's where you see a lot of, I would say, opportunities. Of course, when you do your proper supply demand on any commodities or on the freight market, you see that this market has an underlying strength. We have seen in few occasions that CTAs has a different way of looking at it. They see a trend and they will go for the trend, whether it's a more bullish one or it's a more bearish one. But they will be able then just to add on, and they can take some of these commodity markets down to levels which I would say a human trader will be struggling to take it down to those levels. But that's, again, creating opportunities. I'm not complaining about the CTAs whatsoever. I just think that you have to take into consideration how they're actually trading their markets.
Okay. And I think you mentioned it's 7 years since you founded Svelland and started trading. I mean, obviously, we went through a period where, I guess, commodity markets were, you know, arguably less interesting in terms of not seeing, you know, such heightened volatility and major moves. I mean, were you, in some senses, anticipating this more active environment, or was that, was it always kind of your goal to have your own firm and trade your own fund?
Yeah, I started thinking about setting up the fund during my Goldman days and also into Trafigura. I felt I had the experience to actually set it up. I had meetings with some key allocators back then in 16 and into 17. They said, you will succeed, but it will take time. And since we didn't have one big sponsor from day one, it was literally my own money and we got some few family office involved. You know, we've just been building this step by step. And I always believed in there are mispricing in these markets. I would say that in some of the larger trading houses, people are sitting more in a silo. They're trading few commodities, and that's what they do. And that's what they try to make their P&L every day, which is understandable because that's their job. But we are looking a little bit on the bigger picture and see if we can catch some of these big moves. And when we have a high volatility against us and we can handle it by, you know, using other instruments against our core positions, then I think it's creating a lot of good opportunities here. Like we saw particularly under the whole Russia-Ukraine situation, we clearly saw that the market was not as tight as the headlines. There was a lot of talks that Russia will not be able to export their crude and their products. We saw them due to the shipping data and confidentially traded the market and used that volatility to our advantage. And again, later on, you know, a few months later, the whole shipping market was start to see the right pricing, but the VLCCs was lagging. And to be able in May, June to then buy futures at literally zero, it was trading negative. You know, as long as you know these markets and you know and you see this kind of opportunities, the risk reward is just fantastic.
Okay, well, I mean, you mentioned focusing on kind of the big picture, so maybe it's good jumping off point is to give a sense on the kind of big picture for commodities. Some people have suggested we're in like another commodity super cycle. Others have just kind of maybe labeled it more as a more volatile period. And obviously, you know, we've had big moves, maybe going back 2-3 years, but maybe the last year in some markets, things like gas, etc., oil has been range bound, copper range bound, things seem to have settled down. So, I mean, what's your big picture view on the commodity markets for the next number of years?
Yeah, so I believe we are in a super cycle. I think that the underinvestments in the oil market from the 14, 15, 16 the metals market from, I would say, 16, 17, and then the shipping market a little bit later from the 17, 18. When the whole ESG hit the market in 19, 20, 21, I keep comparing some of the pricing back then, similar to the dot-com. It was literally four people with a PowerPoint presentation and say they will produce some electricity. It was completely out of control. During that period, the whole shipping, metals market and oil market was even more out of favor. And that's the reason why we are now going into the super cycle. I can't see any investment changing this view, whether it's on the metal side, oil or shipping. Yes, we have some ships being ordered on the container side after the pandemic. Yes, we have some LNG ships coming into the market and LPG, but I think also the underlying for all these are quite strong. We will need the ships and the tanker market, the dry cargo, is hardly any ships coming in. Many are saying that, you know, you can just build this market and oversupply. If you take into consideration that 80% of the shipyard capacity is kind of reduced since 08, 09, it's very hard to actually build this and oversupply this market. The same on metals. Yes, the copper market has been trading sideways. Yes, we haven't had the spike to the 10, 11, 12. I still think it will happen. What is going to happen in a month's time or 3 or 6 months, I'm not sure, but I'm fairly confident that the supply side will slowly be telling us the situation, and then we have the spike. And this is very similar to some of the other metals.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we've already seen that with uranium, I guess, in the last while, where, you know, supply disappointments have triggered spikes, and obviously gold has started to move up maybe on other factors. But so, I mean, from that, useful just to get your sense on that before we go back to the kind of the supply side. But, you know, what has been the, has it been weakening Chinese demand, or what has been the story for kind of that kind of flattish trend we've seen in some of the major industrial commodities over the last 12 to 18 months?
If you look back 18 months, the market was trading, as you're correctly saying, very sideways. I will say that already then we start seeing a fairly tightening in the copper market. If you're following all the CTA reports, they were maxed short, meaning literally 100% net short. We're never challenged, and we never had any spikes, so they could continue rolling those short positions. Now, when the market is getting even more imbalanced, then they can't. You don't find a new trend. The trend has kind of stopped. You see now that the CTAs are more long copper, and then you slowly will find the footing for a new leg up. I think CTAs won the 18 months back when they just kept selling and rolling, and the macro funds who kind of liked it, they were kind of got stopped out. When you just look at China in general on copper, I think last year demand was up 7%. Most people are kind of a little bit misunderstanding what copper actually goes to. I would say majority of all headlines are all about housing, and people don't really look into all the infrastructure. They don't look into the EV story, the solar story, etc. So that's, I think, probably one of the biggest misunderstanding in the market. This is also linked to other things in China. If you look at the iron ore market, right today, it's been trading a bit weaker. But if you go back again 18 months ago, majority was super bearish on iron ore. It literally went from 100 to 140 when people expected to hit 70. So again, China had the demand. They are also producing steel for export, and goes also into other than just the steel. So it's a bit mixed. I think it's too easy to just look at how things were in the good old days. If you thought back then that this is a new 08 situation, and what will you do if we have a big recession? Then you will short copper, you short oil, you short a few other metals. I think at this time around, I disagreed on this view of a recession in the US. which we've been quite vocal about, and we're ending up being in a situation that the oil and the metals market, shipping market, just getting tighter and tighter.
So, I mean, you touched on the kind of the underinvestment theme, and a lot of people point to that, and obviously then equally point to a number of other kind of structural factors which should support the market over time. Obviously, you've got the energy transition, which will obviously require these base commodities as part of the transition. You know, you've got other factors such as like growing defense spending, deglobalization, nearshoring, all of that. I mean, when you think about that big picture, are you focused on any subset of those themes, or do you think is it all part of the story? Or what would you highlight as being the most significant thing that makes you, you know, upbeat on that we're in that kind of super cycle?
You know, I'm a big fan of the renewable market and what they can provide of good and cheap electricity. We just have to also be very realistic and how they're going to produce and the investment and the investment thesis and how much you can expect return of capital. I think the hydrogen has been struggling. I think we will see some good companies coming out of hydrogen as well. On hydropower, the big misunderstanding there is that majority think that that's the batteries of Europe. But, you know, the people owning hydropower are just using the market in their advantage, holding back, and will try to sell into spikes in the market like everyone else. On the solar, I think it's been a fantastic investment case for many. The price keep dropping and they start getting better and better usage and electricity. When it comes to the wind, I think that's where the big fight in Europe has been and a few other places. The offshore is obviously not working the way people expected. The overrun on cost, just operational problems has been more than expected. I think the onshore wind so far has been a great success, particularly in South Europe. Let's see how it's going to be developing more in the Scandia and North Europe. Very exciting to follow how that will develop. But it all comes down to when they're producing electricity, when the power grids really needs that electricity, and when we will have what I call the energy storage batteries, the large ones, and how that all going to work out.
Okay. And I mean, translating those kind of trends into an investment perspective or a way for identifying investment opportunities, are you looking for the equity stocks that will benefit from that transition, or do you see it more impacting the commodity futures? Or I mean, how do you kind of take those broad trends and translate that into trades?
Yeah, you know, we start always with the supply demand on the commodities. So whether it's on the coal or it's on the nat gas, oil, etc. Then it's all about how much can they produce, who's buying it, who's selling it, and then the political landscape. As you have now clearly seen, Europe was completely against using nat gas at all. Then that after a lot back and forth, they accepted nat gas to be part of a transition fuel. I think this is all wrong. We should just accept that nat gas is polluting 50% less than coal, and we should be very supportive to the whole nat gas industry. When it comes to the renewable companies, the companies we like and we are long as we speak are companies that are producing and they have proven track record. They are now in a situation they can pay dividends and they can be quite of, you know, low volatility stocks, but high return. So I like some of these stocks as long as the management is not being overly keen to expand, and they know when they expand in which countries, and that they can actually run it properly. It's always a bit challenging in few countries to run renewable projects.
And I mean, translating this whole energy transition into, you know, kind of impact on commodities themselves, is there's, I mean, people will often point to, you know, copper as being as maybe being one of the primary beneficiaries. Obviously, you didn't really touch on nuclear, but presumably, obviously, the uranium trend is linked to that. You know, if you were to say to people, okay, these are the markets that are going to really benefit from this energy transition because these are the base commodities that we're going to need, which ones would you highlight in particular?
For us, the number one is copper. I know a lot of people have been talking about copper. That is the critical one, and that it could be challenged from lithium and others. But with all the expertise we at least have, we need the copper, whether it's into power grids or it's into the batteries or et cetera. So the copper is far the number one. I think on the lithium, the market has been more balanced and part of the market has also been oversupplied. So, you know, we're always coming back to that copper is the key one and where we would like to have the right positions on. We are more in favor of using copper futures than the companies. Nothing wrong with the companies. I think some of the companies are really good. Unfortunately, they are facing a lot of issues in their producing countries like Peru and Chile, whether it's on the environmental or the political landscape, or it's struggling to do the production that they're hoping to do. So we think that through our supply-demand view, that the copper future will give us the best return. In the future, maybe aluminium will be part and also leading electricity and could be used. We are following that closely and obviously following the aluminium companies and what they are communicating, what is Alcoa and Norsk Hydro.
Okay. And I mean, from a macro perspective, you know, I guess this obviously has ramifications as well. And I guess one of the debates that we have in markets at the moment from a macro perspective is have we really moved to kind of a different regime, a different environment to that of the last decade? And, you know, that throws out all kinds of debates, such as, you know, is the natural rate of interest higher than in the past because we're going to see, you know, higher levels of investment and structurally higher inflation? I mean, do you see this scenario of this energy transition and pushing up demand for commodities and pushing up commodity prices being consistent with a different macro backdrop? Is that something that's a key part of the thesis as well?
Yeah, I think we have now through the last few years been a little bit spoiled with low energy prices and people take that for granted. We will now slowly face some spikes. When we see the spikes, then the politician will start talking why is this happening? And then they will start doing whatever they can to help out. I think the US politician or the European, I think they're constantly behind the curve. And I think that when we have a problem, then they will try to sort it out. And then they have to realize to start a new copper mine takes 10, 15, maybe even 20 years. And I think some of the politicians are start realizing this, and this will be the problem in the coming years. So if you look at how Nasdaq and some of the companies are trading, they're all focusing on the tech side, and the capital flow easily go from being the value companies into the growth. And when we see that capital flow, we also see immediately less activities in our markets. This will, over time, going back and forth. But for now, we have had this unbelievable rally in the tech companies. When this is taking a breather, we will immediately see capital flow back into the commodity space. All these companies is producing, you know, just take an example with Microsoft. They want to have more data center to run IE. In order to run this, they need more electricity. So they are setting up, particularly in the Scandi countries, because of their clean energy. And so it's like a complete mismatch what these companies, the market cap, and what they actually need. They need more energy. So, and who's going to produce it? So I think this will slowly get back to more normal situation. Right now it's extreme with Nasdaq performing the way it has, and then, you know, some particular companies, we all have this, you know, seen this seven bigs dragging the indexes up. So this will get back to normality. I think we also will see some of these larger IT companies coming into our space and start investing and making sure that they have the access to the cheap electricity, which they are so dependent on.
When you say extreme, do you mean the extreme difference between their market valuation and their access to cheap, currently cheap electricity? And that's at an unusually wide level at the moment, is that it?
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, Microsoft is a fantastic company. Apple is a fantastic company. But all these companies needs, you know, the raw materials to create what they're selling. And they need, with the data center, they need more electricity than ever. And I think people are completely misreading the demand. And it's only the energy complex that can provide them with this energy. So it's a... That mismatch will you know, flatten out and be more normal. But right now it's a bit extreme.
Okay, and just going back to something you said earlier, you talked about kind of when we had the Russia-Ukraine conflict and market pricing got extreme there as well. But you could see kind of in the shipping data that they were actually they were kind of circumventing the sanctions effectively and exporting. So it kind of highlights that you have that interesting vantage point of with this kind of perspective on freight markets and shipping markets as to see what the kind of the flow of goods through the system. I mean, when you look at that now, what does that tell you about what's going on in the markets? Obviously, we've had the Red Sea disruptions and shipping goods has taken longer, but that's kind of seems to have been a one-off adjustment and the market seems to be dealing with that. But I mean, from that vantage point, so shipping and freight, are you seeing anything interesting about the kind of temperature in the global economy?
So majority of when you're listening to, whether it's the Bloomberg TV or the CNBC, which I think is a fantastic show, I think when they normally talk about shipping, it's always containers. 80-90% of the cases, containers, which is fine. But for us, who's a niche player, we're very much into the details. So for us, when you talk about the freight market, you have to split it into LNG, LPG, crude oil, products, dry cargo, car carriers, containers, and the dry cargo. So you have all these markets and they work quite differently. What I find interesting that LPG has recently been trading at all-time high. So if you go into end of last year, into beginning of this year, we traded at the north of $100,000. If you go 4 years back and you said you will fix a VLGC at $40,000, it was considered as a very high market. Then you look at LNG, the last 2 years, of course, has an influence on the Ukraine-Russia situation. But LNG... period market has been holding at $80,000 to $150,000 per day, which again, historically, very high. On tanker, then it's both the crude side and the products, both markets trading really well. Dry cargo has now been, was trading a little bit low end of last year. Now into this year, we're trading $40,000 on good ships, on the Capesize and the Newcastle Max. Again, very historically very strong numbers. We just had the 10-year high of export out of Brazil on iron ore. Then on containers, you know, small hiccup in the Red Sea. The container rates went from 800 to 3,500 from China to Europe. Again, indicating how so little happening, small happenings, and it's going from, you know, cash break, below crash break even to making money. So if you're taking all these markets, then they're all showing very strong returns. Most of these companies on top, they have no debt issues. If they need to refinancing, they can. And they've been also very firm on not ordering too many vessels. So across the shipping space, is telling us the world economy is perfectly fine. If the situation was the opposite, the tankers was really weak and dry cargo, I would say, would be very important to follow, and was down to below OPEX, that would be a red flag from the way I see. So across all this market, the market is very strong, very strong.
Okay. And I mean, would you, if we were to say start to see signs of recession, you would expect to see that then? I mean, would you expect to see that in those dry cargo and freight and shipping markets before you see it in the kind of high frequency data that we all monitor kind of week in, week out?
Yeah, I've always been following the shipping market in the sense that when you can talk about demand, you can talk about that the market should be okay. But what I like to look at is what actually happens. Did they load the cargo? Did they take it to, let's say, China? Did they discharge it? Or did they just sit outside China for whatever reason? But when you load, you ship it, you discharge, and the overall price on the commodity is within a normal range, then I would say the market looks okay. So if you go back to, 97, it was a full stop, clearly indicating the Asian crisis was coming. 08 into 09, we saw, especially on the dry cargo, market collapsing. The steel market in China was limit down, which is 6% for 10 trading days. That's a clear indication that we have a full stop in the world economy. And I just can't see enough of those signals as we speak. So over the last 2 years, it's been again and again about recession. And if you just look at the freight complex, it's been clearly indicating that the world economy is fine.
And when you look at the pattern of trade or the pattern of demand in these markets, has that changed in any way in the sense that the global economy in aggregate is doing fine, but there have been pockets of weakness? Obviously, Germany has been in a recession or very close to recession, the UK the same. Is it the fact that are you seeing that transition in the composition of global demand more towards emerging markets, places like India, Indonesia? Is that part of what you're picking up, or do you have that level of granularity on it?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. It's the emerging markets, India, surprisingly strong. We have been hoping for India to be this strong for many, many years. Now it's finally happening. Even though people normally talking negative and bearish on China, but most of them that is talking bearish about China only talk about the property market. There's so much more to China than just the property market. They are shifting towards more service and then the infrastructure part and housing will, of course, take a beating. I think the BRICS country, the Brazil, the India, the China, and now we're including Saudi, Russia. I think that constellation is very strong. I think they will go from strength to strength. Big part of the world population is involved in those countries. And I think they will be very dominating players in the commodity space. They have access to the commodities. I think Europe and US has unfortunately been behind the curve here, and they have not been understanding the seriousness of who actually controls the commodities in the future. So this is particularly on the metal side. On oil is obviously a little bit different with the US export going from strength to strength. But the balance between the BRICS country, emerging markets, and the Western world is definitely tipping in the favor of the BRICS and the emerging markets.
And I mean, again, taking this to a macro perspective, obviously, if we go back to COVID and that period, the market was intently focused on, supply deliveries, shipping costs, all of these, disruptions to containers, containers sitting in the port of LA, not being able to move through the system, etc. And, it gave a very good leading signal on the inflation spike that we saw. Obviously, since then, inflation has come down. Plenty of people saying, disinflation is the major trend. But we've obviously had then a little bit of a hiccup more recently in the trend in inflation. I mean, are you seeing enough tightness in these markets to suggest to you, okay, inflation might be sticky, or can you draw that inference from what you're seeing in the commodity markets?
Yeah, if you take the combine the commodity market and the freight market, it's now all trading at a fairly healthy level, and it will obviously have impact on the inflation. And I would from if you just take that part of the total inflation situation, then it's not supportive to get the inflation down. So I think, as you described on the container market, I used that to our benefit back, under the pandemic and the aftermath, and then, piling up with containers. And then when it finally hit the wall, it came off very rapidly. Let's see now with the whole Red Sea situation and the Houthis, how they're acting. If they continue their attacks, it will have effect on the world economy. From a freight and commodity point of view. So longer distance and less efficiency on the how they're running the whole operation will have a negative effect.
And I mean, when that happened, I suppose analysts were kind of initially scrambling to try and get a sense of, okay, how significant is this? And you described kind of container costs have jumped up on the back of it, but maybe too early to say that we're seeing any impact on kind of import prices or consumer prices yet. But I mean, how do you see that scenario playing out, and how extreme could it get in terms of its impact on the global economy?
Yeah, as long as we have the cheap gas, as we have now to US, and the situation in Europe is very much under control, Qatar's willingness to increase and flood the market, I think Saudi on the oil side is doing their job to balance these markets. I don't think they really want to go too high. I don't think they wanted to be very much below 80 on Brent. If this continues that way, the renewable companies are slowly coming in and producing more electricity, and the energy complex stays more or less where we are right now. I think that will be very, very important for the world economy. But if we keep having problems and the energy cost and the energy price rising rapidly, I think will be a big setback for the world economy.
Okay. And we've already seen, I guess, that impact of higher energy costs in Europe in particular, in terms of, German industrial capability and being hit with some of the more energy intensive sectors, either... closing completely, and increasingly we're seeing, I guess, companies moving to the US for their new factories, etc., given the cheaper gas over there. What's your perspective on how Europe meets its energy needs on a multi-year basis? Obviously, they tap into the LNG markets, ahead of the kind of not the most recent winter, the previous winter, I think, but have dodged a bullet, I think, when people were very concerned going back 18 months. But we have had two relatively mild winters, I think. Is that still a structural risk factor, do you think, in Europe, or how do you see that playing out?
I must say I'm very impressed about the EU and all the countries that has been able to set up receiving facilities in a short period of time. I've been able to receive all the LNG from US, and particularly Qatar. Right now, I can't see that this is a problem. The inventory is in Europe at 61%. So we are in a fairly good shape compared to last year. I think the flexibility and the additional from the renewable space has got us into a good position. Let's see now when we see more industrial activities. Again, we know that in Italy, we know parts of Germany has been shutting down. And if they then start being back to normal, what will happen to the particularly to the gas market and the electricity market? Right now, it looks balanced. And since we can use the coal import, I'm not a big fan of it, but they keep using it. and the gas situation, it is where it is. It should be good for Europe. I think that's also one of the reasons why the German stock market, which I normally will use as an indicator for Europe, has been trading extremely well lately, even though that Germany has been into, I would say, a technical recession.
Good stuff. Well, some of the other factors, I mean, obviously we talked about the energy transition. I guess some of the other topics that people point to in terms of this kind of structurally bullish scenario for commodities is around geopolitics and defense spending. And that's certainly been a theme we've heard out of Europe a lot in the last few weeks about the need for ramped up defense spending in relation to, you know, perceived threat from Russia on one side. But it is, I guess, a more general trend in the US as well. I mean, how does that impact the commodity markets? What are the kind of the obvious and typical winners within the commodity complex from higher defense spending?
You know, there are more and more countries, not just in Europe, but other places across the world, have been agreeing to a 2% spending is within what they should accept. It took a few years for many countries to accept it. Trump was very clear on this in his previous presidency period. I think he will be there again quite aggressively. Was he unfair? Probably not. And the winners on this will, as we have seen now in China, a lot of the ships that are being built is into the building a solid Navy fleet. Again, back to maybe why iron ore was trading higher. I think we will continuously see more spending across the whatever weapons they want to produce. And then it goes without saying, obviously positive for commodities, whether it's the iron ore, is the copper, or is the smaller metals. But that's, that all will be in great demand.
And I mean, one of the things, obviously, that people always kind of talk about with relation to commodities is, you know, geopolitical risk, and, you know, that we'll have a conflict. And, you know, obviously, particularly the energy markets, you tend to see periodic spikes. The Gulf War, obviously, and then obviously more recently, the Russia-Ukraine conflict. I mean, from a portfolio management perspective, is that it can be a presumably a difficult one to navigate in the sense that these are tail risks that are ever present in markets, but obviously we go through long periods of stability. And if we go back, obviously, 2 years ago, everybody was talking about heightened geopolitical risk in the immediate aftermath of the Russia attack. And, you know, as things have gone on and as commodity markets have stabilized, that's been less of the narrative, but remains there in the background. So is it just about having kind of out of the money option structures, or how do you think about kind of constructing a portfolio to take advantage of those periodic spikes, but cognizant that they are very episodic?
You know, it's all this is complex, and we saw that after the Russia Ukraine, you would expect U.S. to challenge most companies within the oil service industry to leave Russia. That did not happen. That's, for me, goes without saying, that was with a blessing from the president, with Biden. So Russia been then able to keep up the production. And that's, again, back to he would like to have low pump prices and low prices in U.S. Iran has been able to increase production during all these conflicts. And why is that happening? I think U.S. have been in the foot that they would like to have low energy prices. Potentially the same with EU, have had the same view. So with Iran up to like 4 million barrels, Russia north of 10, and then you have U.S. Increasing, and then particularly last year, their export, production and export, then this year is probably going to be more flat, but still at a high level. Then you have Saudi in a very difficult position. Do they want to flush the market, or they want to keep the market fairly stable from a price level? So that's kind of the situation. And they've decided to have the more or less the oil market where it is. Could we have shocks going forward? My view is yes, but that will have Iran involved one other way. It will be that there is clearly stated that the Houthis is backed by the Iranian. And in case of a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel, I think they're going to continue. And I think the market are pricing in that it will continue. So the shipping will be interrupted for a long period of time. I'm a bit surprised that the oil market are happy to trade at fairly low volatility when the underlying markets are quite challenged and can be challenged. But that's just the situation. And we have not been trading these markets with all this noise, and still we are trading with low volatility, which we again also seen in the equity market and on index level, and also in the FX market. So let's see going forward that we are so confident that nothing can happen. But that's the situation right now.
And I mean, is that, we talked about CTAs and their influence on markets, but do you see, you know, structured products or volatility sellers having a similar impact in these markets, particularly when a range gets established? Is that a feature, would you say?
Yes, they the way they're trading, and we have been in dialogue with many of the CTAs in the market and how they are programmed and how they are running it. They are, in many cases, trading very different to a human trader. I'm not saying that the human trader is the ultimate trader. I'm more into that they're particularly on the short side when you're getting commodity prices and shipping markets down to what is, you know, break even, and you're down into where you're losing money on production. I don't think a trend follower really understand the dynamic when you're hitting the floor, when you're hitting that people will just stop supply overnight and then you will have the spikes. That hasn't happened yet, but that will happen at some stage. When that happens, then they will also take a stand back. I think in the freight market, the CTAs has got a lesson how brutal it can be, particularly on the Capesize, on those FFA. They had a massive rally from the 5,000-6,000 up to 30,000-35,000. So for now, the CTAs macro funds has been part of reducing the volatility. And so let's see how this develops. But I just don't believe that the volatility in the commodity market is a history. And from now on, we can always trade in a calm water.
Yeah. And I mean, we've talked about a number of the kind of the structural factors underpinning kind of the commodity story, supply constraints, energy transition, defense spending. I guess the other one that is kind of deglobalization and nearshoring, which is, I guess, again, an offshoot of heightened geopolitical risk and COVID as well. And we've seen it certainly in the US with stronger manufacturing of facilities for manufacturing production. Again, from thinking about impact on commodity markets, is it the same usual suspects? I guess copper benefits on anything that's kind of construction related. But any other observations on how that theme and trend of deglobalization and nearshoring is impacting the commodity markets?
Yeah, I think particularly for Europe and US, they will slowly see that they're missing out on some of the, I would say, smaller metals. And they will try to find a solution how to get their hands on it. If you go across Africa and see who literally controls Africa from a commodity point of view, you will see that Russia and China is more or less in control. So majority of commodities are controlled by the Chinese, and there has to be finding some kind of solution or cooperation with China. I think if Trump comes out and playing the same as he did last time, trade war and aggressively going after China, I think the commodity market can get very messy, and we will see a shortage of commodities, particularly in the Western world.
Okay. And that's across the complex where obviously China is the source of a lot of the rare earths as well, isn't that right?
Yeah. So all the smaller ones. So, you know, US is perfectly fine on the coal side. Iron ore, they're fine. All the ags, you know, on oil and the gas. So both LPG and LNG. So they are fine, but they will be missing out on the small ones. So as long as they're also pushing more of the factories back to US, there will be high demand for some of the smaller metals.
Okay. And so, I mean, taking all of that together and translating that into kind of a multi-year view, I mean, where would you say, are there particular, obviously, I imagine you're very opportunistic in your strategy, but if you were to, you know, kind of construct investments or positions on a multi-year basis from here, where would you be focusing in on as the major opportunities as a commodity trader?
No, we like the general metals market. I think iron ore is more supplied than the rest, but I would say across metals, I think we will face a lot of shortage and you will have a fairly tight market. I think gold will be trading very well, not just because of the general way of looking at gold, but I think you will look at gold that the BRICS countries and others have been buying and the fiscal gold and they keep it. So on all the freight markets, probably a little bit except for the containers, will be trading well. Oil, you know, the demand is now up to 104. It's more people on the planet, it's more, you know, need for all kind of oil products. So it will be trading well, but it's all up to how the Middle East and particularly Saudi will run the supply side. But on the multi-year, the metal side and the shipping will have many, many years that will do very well.
Okay. And you touched on sometimes how you can see these differences in pricing between the equity market and the commodities. And we're seeing that maybe in a sense in the gold versus the gold miners. Any observation as to why the gold miners have been so slow to benefit from the rise in gold and any perspective as to how that plays out?
I think it's very much about the whole, how much are they able to produce. I think it's difficult to run the mining operation. A lot of environmental headaches, political headaches. It's just a never-ending story with problems. And also to switch into the financial market and find support for mining, I think it's still difficult to get to many of the key lenders. They in many cases will say literally it's from the board level that we're not allowed to lend to your business. So that's one of the problems, particularly on the gold side. I think we have the exactly same on copper, which is a surprise. I would thought that the majority of the larger banks was there to support the industry. So if you look into shipping, I still think you will be surprised the how many banks that has left the industry. We see now there are some new banks coming back in Europe, but for a long period of time, we had literally only some very few banks in the Scandi, where this was DNB, Nordea, SEB, and then some ABN AMRO, but besides that, it was very, very few that was willing actually to give some lending capacity into the shipping market.
Yeah. And I mean, in other markets, what you're seeing is that gap being taken up by private capital. Is that something you're seeing in commodities? And I think I understand some of the larger trading houses are now acting as lenders as well. Is that something that you see there?
Yeah, I think for the Middle East capital and lenders, they're happy to go to the larger institution, whether it's Vitol, Trafigura, Glencore, etc., and back them. They're good companies. It's more safe to give them money than to the smaller ones. So their concentration on the larger trading houses, I think, will continue. You see the same on the oil companies. I think it's very hard to break in as a smaller oil company. Hence the reason why Equinor, Exxon, Chevron, etc., are all doing well and will continue doing well.
Okay, good stuff. I'm conscious of time. We're coming up to the hour. We always like to get our guests to give some advice to people. And I guess from your perspective, obviously being an expert and specialist in commodities and shipping and freight, I mean, for people who want to learn more about those markets and want to get some good reading material, anything you would particularly recommend as a starting point?
I think if you really want to learn the industry and a little bit of the history, I think The World for Sale, that book is fantastic. I happen to know quite a few people in the book, and they're all telling me that it's very precise. So I think the two gentlemen that wrote the book did a very thorough job. I think both Goldman and Morgan are producing good research across metals and oil. They've been there for many years, so they keep doing well. And then I think Bloomberg is doing a great job on some of their articles, which I think in many cases are very much what's happening. So I think that will be probably the easiest one to access.
Very good. Well, Tore, thanks very much. It's been a great conversation. So thank you very much for doing this today. So make sure to follow Tore's work, because as you can tell from today's conversation, we're living in a truly global macro-driven world, and it's more important than ever to stay well-informed on all things global macro and commodities. So from all of us here at Top Traders Unplugged, thank you for tuning in, and we'll be back more soon with some more exciting episodes.
Thanks for listening to Top Traders Unplugged. If you feel you learned something of value from today's episode, the best way to stay updated is to go on over to iTunes and subscribe to the show so that you'll be sure to get all the new episodes as they're released. We have some amazing guests lined up for you, and to ensure our show continues to grow, please leave us an honest rating and review in iTunes. It only takes a minute, and it's the best way to show us you love the podcast. We'll see you next time on Top Traders Unplugged.